Hello, and welcome to another podcast of U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Jean. This is Jimmy LaSalle. In this episode, we conclude our interview with Angela Sutton, and Jeannie is going to take this right from the start. Jeannie, take it away.
Today, we continue with our conversation with Angela Sutton, an interpretive ranger at Tule Lake National Monument. We left off talking about how the rights of the detainees were completely taken away. At Tule Lake, the constitutional rights of detainees were more than just being violated. For many, their constitutional rights did not exist.
And it's true. You start going through even just the basic Bill of Rights, and almost every single one of them was violated with no cause, no justification, no due process. Multiple stockades were built at Tule Lake during this time, with the final one being what's now within Park Service management today. A concrete jail is built here, and men are being put into that with no notice, no due process, no justification. Literally, what's written on the intake sheet is just troublemaker. No actual charges or anything. And these individuals within Tule Lake, a committee gets formed. They reach out to Wayne Collins first to try to get the jail shut down and proper procedure to be followed. While he's coming and checking in on those things, and he is successful getting it closed a couple times, that it kept getting reopened and getting moved around a little bit, he starts hearing of all these individuals renouncing their citizenship, and he starts questioning them and finds out that many are doing it partly out of protest and a lot out of fear. Many truly believe that because of all the stigma that is attached to Tule Lake, and it's still there today, that, you know, these are the no-nos, the troublemakers, the anti-American, pro-Japan people who were sent to Tule, they truly believe that when they're forced out of camp, because some of the facilities are closing in 44 and early 45, that when they're forced out of here, they will never be accepted in the United States. No one's going to rent them a place to live. No one's going to hire them for jobs. They truly are fearful that they will not be able to start over in the United States. And Wayne Collins pretty much tells them that's a lie. That's not true. He will help them. Some are even being told the only way they can go to Japan is if they give up their citizenship. And he's letting them know that no, that's not the case. They can go as an American citizen. And he takes on over 4,000 individual court cases. He tried to do a major like class action suit and just get the whole thing annulled at one point.
Sure.
And the government and court system pushes back and said, no, these people individually filed. You will individually represent them. You can lump them as families, and that's it. And Wayne works on these court cases for over a decade. He's also one of the reasons why Tule Lake stays open so much longer than all the rest. All the other camps are closed by 1945. Tule Lake stays open until March of 1946. It's almost 6 months after the war is officially ended, and this place was still open and holding individuals. And part of that was for that brief little window, Tule Lake does become a safe haven. Because for those renunciants who do not want to go to Japan, who do want to get their citizenship back, as long as they're being held here, they're not being deported. And they're not being put into a different facility. And so Wayne keeps filing injunctions to keep the place open to protect that group of renunciants whose court cases he's working on. And eventually, as we reach that six-month mark, the government pushes back and says no. Absolutely not. We're not keeping this open any longer. The facilities were never supposed to be open for the whole duration of the war. And now that it's open, there is truly no justification whatsoever that they can come up with to justify it. And that's where those Department of Justice facilities really come into play at Tule Lake. It's decided if you are, you know, far enough along in your court case that everything points to you will be granted your citizenship back, then you are released from the center, just like anyone else, but you are to maintain contact with your lawyer, with Wayne, so he can keep working on your case. And he knows where your whereabouts are, so if your case doesn't work out the way is expected, Wayne can report your location and authorities can step in. Yeah. If not that far in your case, you're just getting started in it, at that point, those families were then sent to Department of Justice facilities, most commonly Crystal City, Texas, because it was designed for families. And they could spend up to 3 more years at the Crystal City Department of Justice internment camp while Wayne continued to work on their case. So that's almost 7 years of being put in some form of an incarceration facility by the government for these families. But Wayne was not well received outside or even within the camp by the administration for his efforts. There are stories of him coming to camp and, you know, them threatening to not give him access to certain portions of the camp, especially the stockade and the jail, and him having to threaten to bring in law enforcement from outside the camp because he has a court order that says he can go anywhere to have them enforce it. His vehicle would be vandalized and sugar would be poured in the gas tank and he would break down a few miles out of camp, but he's trying to get all the way back to San Francisco. You would think they would help him. They weren't. They were against him. They had washed their hands of everyone at Tule Lake. They felt that they had renounced and therefore they should not receive any assistance from anyone in the United States. Some groups were actually actively trying to get Wayne Collins disbarred so he couldn't continue with his cases. So he had a really big uphill battle, and he was quoted in court as saying, you know, has no Japanese ancestry background in his family history. But he was quoted as saying if he was put through the same conditions as what Japanese Americans at Tule Lake were put through, he would have renounced his citizenship. Just because he would not want to be in a country. He felt they never should have been given that option and that it was a completely justified option for them, or a justified reason for them to accept that option and renounce, because why would you want to be here after that kind of treatment? And
sure.
He fought really, really hard for them for over 10 years.
That's incredible. And if you think about, you know, as the war ended and many of the camps started to close, what sort of systems were put in place to help people who now, if they had a home, maybe somebody else was living in it, or they sold it for way under market value, or it had been seized by the government? How do people build their lives back?
They had to start all over. You walked into camp with only what you could carry, and you walked out with only what you can carry. And you had to start over. Some were very fortunate, and they had non-Japanese American neighbors who had looked over their businesses or their farms. For some of those individuals, was that their very own personal risk, even not just financial risk, but personal well-being. Like one gentleman was shot at by his neighbors because he was trying to protect 6 different Japanese American families' farms during the war and keep them prospering. And he would not tell the Japanese American families that after they came home, because he didn't want to put that extra burden on them to know that he had to go through it. The only reason they found it out is because they found the gunshot in his barn and kept pushing him until he finally admitted that, okay, I didn't slip the hammer. That's actually what someone tried to shoot at me. And so there were some who were very fortunate who had neighbors like that, but they're very few. Lots, you know, went back to different cities and what they were used to. One gentleman I knew, he was originally from the San Jose area. He didn't even try to go back to San Jose. He went straight down to Los Angeles, started over there. Eventually he settled in San Jose, but it took him almost 20 years to work back to where he was. And we see a bit of a shift too, where as individuals went into camp, it's that Issei generation who's the head of the household and has the businesses and is taking care of everything. And they were the ones who by far lost the absolute most. And so as they're coming out, they're very dependent on their Issei children to support them and help find them places to live and let them live with them and take care of them. And so we really see that shift in who's the head of the household role and who's taking on all the responsibility. And the Niseis worked really hard, but when it came down to, you know, it's time to leave camp, if your family had less than $500 in their savings account, you were given $25 per person and your bus or train ticket and the date to leave. that was it.
That's it.
If your family had more than 500 in their savings account, you were just given a schedule and a date to leave by. It was on you to figure out your transportation. And so you walked in with what you could carry and you walked out and had to start all over. People found people taking over their homes, and depending on the county and where they lived and how they were received outside camp, because some communities really pushed to not have persons with Japanese ancestry come back. And so when they tried to come back and there were squatters on their property, the authorities did absolutely nothing. Like, we don't want you here. They've been in this house for 4 years. As far as we know, they're the only ones who's ever lived here. It's not yours. You have no proof. Other communities who did want to see their Japanese American neighbors come back, the authorities did step in and would try to follow the laws. But there were few and far between.
I mean, you look at what happened and the fact that, you know, the story needs to be told so that people truly can wrap their minds around what happened. When people visit Tule Lake today, what do they see?
So we're still young as a National Park Service site. We became our own full-fledged standalone National Park Service site in 2018. When the camp closed in 1946, everything on the property reverted back to the Bureau of Reclamation. And their original plan for this footprint was for it to be homesteaded by war veterans coming into the area. Everything around the outside of the camp is developed that way. It was homesteaders coming in from anywhere from World War I to World War II, receiving parcels of land, building on it, and farming. And so they immediately stripped almost everything off the property to try to get it back down to just ground level to put it up for the post-World War II homestead allotments. So barracks were very quickly cut in half, hauled off to homesteaders who were in the area or new ones that were coming in 46, and distributed all over the basin. But what happened is farmers who were here throughout the war knew there was a whole water system, so a full water and sewer system. And they were warning those new out of the area World War II veterans coming in saying, hey, don't pick this parcel because you're going to have water lines and sewer lines that you're going to have to deal with. And they had to be, per the homestead laws, on their property and making it profitable within 6 months. And if you've got to dig up all of this entire water system underneath, you're not going to meet that 6 month deadline and then you lose everything. And so as we roll through, you know, the 46 through 48 homestead lot allotments, nobody picks any of the property within the boundary. So the county comes to the Bureau of Reclamation and says they would like to put an airport here. So over most of the residential portion of the camp, there is now a small airport sitting on top of that. A lot of the original footprint is now covered and owned privately, either by truly individuals and their own individual lots or by the combination of the airport that's through a couple different holders. When the National Park Service site was created originally by presidential proclamation, it was a park in name only. There was actually no land officially tied to the site. And so we worked with state and other federal entities to look at what property and buildings still remained on the property that were in some form of state or federal holding. And so there was the historic jail, which is this concrete building, and the stockade area in the state of California owned it as part of California Department of Transportation. They had already made the decision almost a decade prior to this becoming a National Park Service site that they recognized the significance and they wanted to hand it over to an entity to manage a property. So once we were created in name, the state was like, please take this. And then the Bureau of Reclamation had neighboring property right next to it that included two more buildings, one that was in its original location and is historic, and another that was drug onto the site, which is the building I'm in now that is our current little visitor center. And so through interagency or interfederal transfers, the Park Service now gets to manage 37 acres of the original footprint, which was over 4,000 acres. We have a very small piece. So when visitors come, we just opened our first on-site visitor center last summer in 2022. And so we're still working on getting more finalized exhibits in it, but they get to come in, see the exhibits, talk to the rangers. We offer tours of the gel, and because so little of the history is known, we've made the decision, instead of just taking you to the gel and just covering that like 44 and 45 history, we actually do a 2-hour tour, and we cover everything that I've talked about and then some in that tour to give you a really in-depth history. And then by the time you get into the gel on the tour, you've really understood what would push someone to that level of choosing to renounce and go through this. And now you're seeing, you know, the worst of the worst conditions within camp in that gel. And why would you be put in here?
Unbelievable what you've done and what you've created from such meager beginnings and hopefully where you're headed. I mean, I hope that you can get to a point where you have those guard towers and the barbed wire and the barracks. You know, I have been to Auschwitz in Poland. I took a number of students there 1 year. And it's one of those things when you're standing on those train tracks and you see that metal fence, Arbeit macht frei, and you're standing in what was the gas chamber, and you can put your fingers on the nail marks in the wall and you can see what happened. Mm-hmm. It is, it's one of those life-changing experiences as you walk around and you see the ugliness of humanity, you know? And I think that, well, I hope that you can get to that point, because I think it would be incredible for people to see, because so much in my research, I mean, I know Manzanar is probably the best preserved mm-hmm. of the camps, but so much of it is lost. Mm-hmm. And if it isn't put back, if the puzzle pieces aren't put back, it just becomes this very silent chapter in history, instead of it needing to be, you know, bells clamoring and saying, hey, look at what we did, and look at how we did it, and we need to never do it again.
Yeah. And I think we always have to keep in mind with Thule versus like Manzanar, is Manzanar, the entire footprint got to be preserved as one big whole. The state acquired the property and then they transferred the whole whole over to the National Park Service. It never got developed on, and Thule got very heavily developed on for, you know, a rural area. So we have a very small portion, but the portion that we have is unique to Thule. No other of the 10 sites ever had a stockade and a gel. And that's the section that we manage and we hold. And so in 2019 and going into 2020, we had a huge, it was a combination of a restoration and a reconstruction of the historic gel. When the center closed, the Bureau of Reclamation was trying to reuse everything they could. That's why the barracks went off the property. They were selling them to homesteaders to turn into homes. I'm a local to the area. And the house that my husband and I live in, it's an old 46 homestead. And our house is an old barrack from camp. You can't tell it if you don't know it, but I know it. And we've, you know, found things related to it to justify writing on the walls and things like that. And so, you know, those fragments still exist. They're just privately. But the historic gel, the Bureau of Reclamation knew it couldn't knock it down. It's solid concrete and rebar, and it was not coming down. So they cut every bit of metal out of it. And amazingly enough, a local family in the area, the wife of the family, was one of the very, very few locals to actually get to come into camp and have interactions with the person with Japanese ancestry in here. She was making deliveries, and it was supposed to be a get in and get out. And, you know, that great quote of, you know, well-behaved women don't make history, sure. That was her. She didn't just hurry up and get out. She started talking to those who she was delivering, because she, you know, was getting all the same propaganda message that everyone else was. But she's driving in and she's noticing the guards are pointing their guns inward. The barbed wire is pointed inward, and you know, this isn't matching up. So she starts asking questions. And when everything closes, she tells her husband, she goes, I want to be able to be part of this story in the future. She goes, someday they're going to want to tell what really happened, and I want to be part of it. And so he showed up at auction and he purchased almost every piece of metal that was in the jail. So we're talking bunk beds, the bars on the windows, the bars on the doors, the cell doors, the hallway doors, all of that. And he took it home and he unloads it, this big massive pile of metal, tells his wife he's never moving it again, and he didn't. He literally built a building over top of it, tore that building down. And unfortunately, they both passed away. I never got to meet them, but I got to meet their son and one of their grandsons. And I was standing out there with her grandson as our archaeologists were looking at the metal to confirm, like, is this really what we think it is? And it was. And he leans over to me and he's like, okay, Ange, is that pile of metal really that significant, or is grandma just a little crazy? And I was like, you have no idea. I said, there's over 1,000 structures associated with the camp. There's only 5 in their original footprint that are managed by the Park Service, and only one historic jail out of every location. I said, your grandma saved the entire guts, essentially, of this building. And between 2019 and 2020, we were able to do this combo restoration and reconstruction and put all of that back in.
Wow.
And it, I mean, we've been doing tours back in there now since 21. So 2 years. This year was the first year that I could go on a tour and not break it down into tears, because just having those cell doors back in place, having the bars back on the windows, the bunks back in a couple of the cells so you could see it, it gives you that feeling. You get to see how tight those quarters were. And then we've added some photos, and we'll continue to add more photos and exhibits in there. But I had one in there before we put the bars in of a gentleman who was in the jail. We were able to determine who he was based off of the graffiti he wrote on the wall. And we reached out to his family, and they gave us a photo of him in Hawaii before the start of World War II. And we used that image because we didn't want to use his camp photo, because that looks like a prison mugshot. And this gentleman literally did nothing wrong. He was in Hawaii because he had just come back to Japan. He was one of the ones that the FBI arrested immediately following Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was a U.S. citizen, they couldn't hold him in a Department of Justice facility. So they sent him to Topaz. He answered the questionnaire. That got him sent to Tule Lake. And he'd only been in the U.S. As an adult since 1938. And that had been his experience, was being removed from Hawaii, sent to Utah, sent here. So he renounced. He's like, I'm going to go back to Japan. Like, I don't want to be here anymore. And renouncing is what gets him put into the jail. And so we had his, he didn't commit a crime. So we didn't want a criminal looking photo. So we had this photo of him and his story there, and I would use it on all my field trips. And we put the bars back up. I couldn't bring myself to put him back in the jail.
In the jail.
Because then I didn't want to put him back behind the bars.
Yeah.
Finally, one of my seasonals, he's like, can I do it for you? And I was like, yes, because we need to still tell a story. We need to have him in there. I said, but I can't bring myself to do it. So he put him back in there. But we've been in there for 2 years, and this is the first summer I've been able to actually do a tour and not break down in tears through it, because it is such a powerful place. I remember when we first put the bars up, our cultural resource program manager called me all in a panic. And she's like, you need to get to the jail immediately. You need to get here right now. I was like, be there in like 10 minutes. And I got there, and the way she was so in panic, I thought something was wrong. I thought like, oh no, the contractor's like really messed up. Like, what happened? And I get out, and she's like wiping her eyes. Like, gosh, she's getting out of her car. And I'm like, what did they do? Like, what did they, like, did they destroy graffiti that we just, like, did we just lose something major? And she's like, the bars are up and it's really shocking, and you need to take a breath, but you need to see it now before everyone else is here. I was like,
yeah,
okay. And I didn't realize, I was like, okay, well, that's a good thing. And she's like, I know it's a good thing. She goes, but it's going to hit a lot harder than we thought it was. And sure enough, I walked in, and she's not a crier either. And we both just lost it, because then it made it that much more real of what these people experienced. And you can step in there, and you can sit on the bunk bed, and you can see how little they could see, how they're only a few hundred yards away from their family, but they feel miles and miles apart. And these men that were held in the stockade in the jail, they had no idea what was going to happen next. you know, their family's literally a few hundred yards away in that barrack, and they truly have no idea if they're going to be reunited with them, or if they're going to be deported, or if they're going to be sent to a Department of Justice facility. They have no clue, all because they were standing up for what they believed and saying, this isn't right. I don't want to be in a country that's going to treat me like this. This is the only choice of protest I have, is to, you know, say no to this questionnaire and renounce my citizenship. And there was men in there that were brand new dads, and they were saying no because they thought the only way they would be able to support their family post-war was to go to Japan and start over, where nobody knew them and no one knew their background. And they're sitting there and they know they've got a wife and a couple month year old baby just a few hundred yards away, and they can't help their wife and they can't be there with their newborn and watch all those milestones. And it's just, it's heartbreaking when you step in there and you start hearing their stories and seeing their photos and knowing what they're going through.
Yeah. I mean, listening to you, it's rare that you have the opportunity to speak to somebody who is doing something that I think you were meant to do. And I think that the work that you have done and continue to do is, you know, it's giving a voice to people who were voiceless. And mm-hmm. even the home that you live in, that's a home now, that was once, you know, maybe a place of really, you know, despair. You've turned that really full circle. So I think it's incredibly beautiful what you've done, and your life's work is so valuable and important. So I thank you for your story today, your time today, and for the work that you've done and the work that you continue to do. And I hope that people will come to Tule Lake and to see you and to go on the tour. And how can people donate so that you have the funds that you need to make it what you hope it can become?
Well, thank you for all that. I do have to make one comment. The only way I could do what I do is due to the trust and the generosity of the survivors and the descendants, because if they didn't share our stories, I would have nothing to go off of. I would be giving you and regurgitating the same facts and figures and numbers and the same propaganda. And if it wasn't for their bravery to open up and share their story, and, you know, being a local puts me in a harder spot, because many of the survivors wondered why the local community, which have been, you know, my great grandparents and stuff, why they didn't help them. And it was because they didn't know what was really happening. But being able to slowly, and it took a while, as it should, to gain enough trust from individuals for them to be willing to share, is truly the only reason I can do what I do. And I'm forever indebted and grateful for all the survivors and descendants who have been willing to share their stories, because if they hadn't been brave enough to live that experience and then eventually open up and share it, we would not know what they went through. And we would be literally just, we wouldn't preserve it to the level it is. We would have not thought it was significant. We would have lived off of those propaganda videos and thought that was the truth forever if these survivors weren't strong enough to be open and share. Yeah. So really can't do anything without them. For the Park Service, we do have our National Park Service website. So it is the traditional, you know, www.nps.gov/TULE. And on there, there's all the information for how to set up a tour, come visit us, donate, what we're working on. Everything lives on that website.
When the camps closed, Japanese Americans were given $25 and a one-way train ticket to go and to reestablish their lives. Faced with pressing short-term challenges, finding jobs, housing, feeding their families, getting their children back into school, few were focused on things like an apology from the U.S. government or reparations payments. Plus, many who had been incarcerated suffered a sense of shame that as a community that they had done something wrong to bring this constitutional violation upon themselves. Many Japanese Americans endeavored to prove themselves, you know, 110% American, so that this would never happen again. A Supreme Court case which challenged the constitutionality of Executive Order 9066 and Japanese incarceration camps was Korematsu versus the United States. Fred Korematsu was a Japanese-American citizen who, in 1942, at the age of 23, he refused to report to a relocation center. He changed his name. He even had a surgical procedure done to have his eyes appear less Asian. He claimed to be of Hawaiian and Spanish descent. He was arrested and he was convicted of disobeying the order. He appealed and his case went all the way to the Supreme Court. In 1944, the Supreme Court ruled against him in a landmark 6-3 decision. And that decision still stands today. The Supreme Court argued that the United States had not violated the constitutional rights of Japanese American citizen Fred Korematsu by incarcerating him during World War II. In the majority opinion, Justice Hugo Black stated the following, and this is a direct quote from that case. Korematsu was not excluded from the military area because of hostility to him or to his race. He was excluded because we are at war with the Japanese Empire, because the properly constituted military authorities feared an invasion of our West Coast and felt constrained to take proper security measures, because they decided that the military urgency of the situation demanded that all citizens of Japanese ancestry be segregated from the West Coast temporarily, and finally, because Congress, reposing its confidence in this time of war in our military leaders, as inevitably it must, determined that they should have the power to do just this, end quote. Long after detention camps had closed, Fred Korematsu's conviction continued to limit his ability to get a job, to support his family. And in 1980, a special commission on wartime relocation and internment of civilians was created. This commission held hearings in 10 different cities. Over 750 witnesses gave moving testimonies. Stories of those who helped to build the camps were told. Stories of those who were forced to live in those camps were heard for the first time. In 1983, a report titled Personal Justice Denied, the CWRIC stated that the camps were wrong and the result of racial prejudice, war hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. The report recommended a federal apology and a monetary reparation of $20,000 per Japanese American affected by Executive Order 9066 and the creation of a $50 million community trust fund. Legal experts and researchers found key documents and information that had been purposely suppressed during Fred Korematsu's trial. And Korematsu's case was reopened in 1983, and the state court overturned his conviction. But the U.S. Supreme Court ruling still stands. The only way to overturn a Supreme Court decision is with another Supreme Court decision. Upon hearing his conviction overturned in the state of California, Korematsu stated the following, and this is a direct quote. Being an American citizen was not enough. They say you have to look like one. Otherwise, they say you can't tell a difference between a loyal or a disloyal American. I thought that this decision was wrong, and I still feel this way. As long as my record stands in federal court, any American citizen can be held in prison or in concentration camps without a trial or hearing. That is if they look like the enemy of our country. Therefore, I would like to see the government admit that they were wrong and do something about it so that this will never happen again to any American citizen of any race, creed, or color. End quote. More than 40 years later, after the end of World War II, President Ronald Reagan signed into law the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. The United States apologized to still living Japanese Americans who had been held in the camps and ordered restitution be paid of $20,000 per individual. In 1998, Fred Korematsu was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Bill Clinton. After the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, when laws were passed that limited people's civil liberties, once again, Fred Korematsu spoke out. He died on March 30, 2005. Today, the Supreme Court case that bears his name, it has been widely criticized, it has been rebuked, but it has never been overturned. We often hear the saying thrown around that an injustice to one is an injustice to all. When we take the time to learn about the true history of an event, which means using the correct terms, calling a spade, when we take the time to ask the right questions, we have the opportunity to learn valuable lessons. It's my hope that you will be inspired to do your own research into the stories of those who were so unjustly detained during World War II by the United States government. They were brave enough to tell their stories. We must be brave enough to listen with open minds and with open hearts.
And that's a wrap. Thank you for listening to U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. Tell your friends about our podcast and where you learn all this great stuff about U.S. history. Follow us on social media and get onto our email list to learn about special events. They're coming up again. There's always more to learn. Talk to you soon.